Hello everyone, I'm not going to wait for the people to come back from the loo, they'll just have to suffer. I wrote this story a few weeks ago when I was travelling on the tube thinking about what happens when people fart. So that's my inspiration for this. It's called Stink Toad. The stinks began in early October. Their arrival almost imperceptible among all the other rancid blowbacks given off by the city. To begin with, as with most bad smells, there was mass embarrassed denial. Hot-faced, defensive people looked to their own drains before accusing others. There was much checking behind fridges and under floorboards, and close scrutiny of the soles of shoes. Within a week, though, the stinks had grown stronger and their outbursts more frequent. Soon across the whole city, day and night, the constant creak and whoosh could be heard of a million windows being thrown open or pulled shut, as if the buildings had all sprouted stubby little wings and were trying to take off. Monica experienced her first bad smell on Saturday morning as she walked to the newsagents to buy the newspapers for Tom. One minute her street smelt just as it always did, of nothing much, and the next it was as though she had pierced the invisible skin of some enormous rotting gut. The air turned putrid and she was drenched in a damp, eggy gas. Stepping back with a gasp and putting her hands up to her nose, she immediately looked around to see what might have caused the terrible smell. But as far as she could see, there was no blocked sewer gurgling with overspill, and no evil-eyed children throwing stink bombs. In fact, it was still early, and the street was silent and almost empty. There was just one other person on the opposite side of the road, a man jogging with a chubby golden retriever trailing behind on a lead. Even as Monica peered at the man through watering eyes, she saw him break his stride and double over as though he was about to throw up. The dog at his heels skittered to a halt too, with a pin-like scrabble of claws on the pavement. It growled first, then whimpered, before burying its face under its paws, as though it was expecting to be severely punished for something doggy it couldn't help. The man looked over at Monica, his face twisted in an ugly display of disgust, and she couldn't help feeling he thought she was to blame in some way. So she hurried past with her head down and her fingers clasped over her nose. Thankfully, a few minutes later, she was on the high street with the bus exhausts and the ripeness of the newsagent's armpits wafting comfortingly around her. On her way back home a few minutes later, the smell had evaporated and the man and his dog had gone too. And by the time she was opening the front door of her flat and calling out to Tom, who was still in bed, she had forgotten all about it. Until that was on Sunday night, when they were standing in a queue at the local multiplex, and something airborne and unwholesome climbed inside her nostrils and curled up at the back of her throat like a fart-flavoured oyster. Tom had been in the middle of telling her an anecdote about the director of the film they were about to see. It had been connected in a roundabout way to Tom's most recent ex-wife, who was something big at Miramax. In fact, Monica had been only half listening to Tom's story. She was also watching a tight pack of teenage girls who were leaning so far over the ice cream counter that their denim-clad behinds stuck out roundly and banged together like soft cloth bells. Monica had been thinking wistfully of her own cinema-deprived childhood growing up in the country, when all of a sudden she saw the girls back away from the ice cream counter and begin coughing and spluttering and waving their hands over their noses. Beyond them, Monica could see the mortified look on the ice cream server's face. He was a young, spotty lad in a white and yellow apron, and he seemed about to burst into tears as his customers dry-heaved and made horribly indiscreet gagging sounds. Monica looked sharply up at Tom, but he had his back to the scene and either didn't notice or was taking pains to ignore the rumpus going on. Nor did he acknowledge the sudden miasma of sour milk, rotten meat, and burnt human hair that had wafted over them. Just once, she thought she saw his nostrils flicker and his left cheek twitched for several seconds, which it did when he was annoyed. Apart from that, he carried on telling his story without a pause until it was their turn to pay for their tickets. When they came out of the film a couple of hours later, Monica couldn't help noticing that a woman in overalls with a bucket of disinfectant was slowly and methodically mopping out the ice cream counter. The sharp tang of fake lemon that assailed her as they walked past reminded Monica of a rumour she'd heard at work earlier in the week, that Tom's ex-wife had been sitting in reception on Tuesday lunchtime. That night she lay awake beside Tom, thinking about his lame excuses for turning his phone off on Tuesday afternoon. She thought about the stink at the cinema too, and then wondered how such a tedious film had ever been allowed to be made. Then she wondered for the 100th time that year if it was finally time to call it a day and leave London. To chuck in her job and just leave. Meanwhile, beside her, Tom's shrill, windy snores quilted the stuffy air with a sweet and sour odour of half-digested Doritos and Coke. In the morning, Tom left for work before Monica so that nobody at the TV studio would guess they were sleeping together. Monica was the producer of a late-night arts discussion programme, and Tom was the show's presenter. He'd once been the critic's choice to follow Timothy Dalton as the next James Bond. Now he was the housewife's choice, telling people what to do with their cultural me time. He was also the first boyfriend Monica had had in 2 years, and at first, even though she wasn't allowed to tell anyone about their relationship, she had been excited and happy to have a man in her flat again. Tom had woken up that morning in a bad mood, as he invariably did on Mondays, and within 10 minutes he'd been out of the flat, saying he'd get his own breakfast at the studio canteen. So it was Monica who opened the fridge and found the toad sitting on the middle shelf. She knew it was a toad and not a frog because of its size. It was as big as a grapefruit, and because its skin was gnarly and scaled like a snake's. It seemed old and weathered and not at all shivery. The toad regarded her solemnly for a moment, as though it had been waiting for a long time for her to come and open the fridge door. Then it opened its mouth and unfolded a quite shockingly long tongue. Not quickly, as though it was snapping up flies, but rudely and obscenely, as though it had a point to make. Then it reeled back the tongue and let out a deep, hollow sound that was not what she had expected at all, but just like the rumble of an empty belly. Monica was so appalled that she immediately took a step backwards into the kitchen, and the toad took its opportunity and jumped down from the fridge shelf and onto the kitchen floor. It landed with a fat, wet splat just a few inches from Monica's bare feet. Monica let out a shriek and jumped backwards, but unperturbed, the toad remained where it was for a full half minute. Then it seemed to shuffle and squat with its hindquarters before springing to about the height of Monica's knees in the direction of the sink. Monica spun round in time to see the thing squeezing and flattening its body through the gap between the floor and the broken bottom of the cupboard under the sink. It left a slimy residue in its wake. Monica called in sick that day and spent the morning cleaning out the fridge from top to bottom. She didn't take any risks and threw out all the food, even though much of it had only just been bought. Once, she gingerly opened the doors to the cupboard under the sink, but there was no sign of the toad. Had it somehow squirmed its way behind the cabinets? Or was it still there, lurking around the overflow pipe, enjoying the gurgle of warm dishwater? Every time she thought about those yellow reptilian eyes and that long muscular tongue, Monica felt the urge to throw up. On the internet, she googled toads and their habits, but found nothing that explained why or even how one could have found its way into her fridge. She tried ringing Rentokil and asking them for advice, but when she dialed the number, the line was engaged, and their website kept crashing too. She ignored the calls from Tom on her mobile and his half dozen increasingly irate emails as they pinged up on her laptop. All day she spoke to no one and only left the house to walk down to the compost heap at the end of the garden. On her way back up the path, she couldn't help noticing that the sky had a strange porridgey texture and that there was a clamminess in the air. Seasons in the city were often indistinguishable, just 6 months of slushy cold followed by 6 of damp warmth. Monica found herself homesick again for the past, for bright autumn mornings adrift with golden leaves and misty afternoons scented with bonfire smoke. Not this menopausal stickiness, this airlessness. That night she watched the local news and saw that several tube stations and one of the towers in Docklands had been closed. Nervous-looking commuters told stories of being led out of trains through tunnels that reeked of rotten fish and feces, and a fleet of industrial cleaners in anti-contamination suits were shown running up the service stairs of Canary Wharf. Monica went to bed with the door to the kitchen closed and the gap between it and the floor wedged with a towel. She also went round putting plugs into all the available plug holes and weighted down the toilet lid with her old walking boots. In the morning, there was a crisscross of slimy trails all over the kitchen floor and a wide line of goo like wallpaper paste close to the kitchen door, as though whatever it was, and it had to be the toad, had spent the night methodically looking for a way out. For the rest of the week, Monica followed the same pattern of behaviour. She went to work and did her best to concentrate on her job. Then every evening when she got home, she took a bucket of boiled water, topped up with half a litre of bleach, and mopped down the kitchen floor, the walls, and all the cabinets. Then she trailed rat poison along the edges of the room where the kitchen cabinets joined the floor, putting extra wide lines at the base of the cooker and the washing machine, and of course taking the trail as far into the hole under the sink cupboard as she dared. After that, she closed the kitchen door and replaced the towel, now soaked through with a mixture of designer aftershave that Tom had left behind and weed killer. She stopped using her own bathroom to wash in and either ate out or brought home takeaways. She was losing her appetite anyway. For the next 4 days, she went to the public swimming pool to use the shower facilities, until Friday, when the pool was closed indefinitely because of a suspected outbreak of E. coli in the children's pool. After that, she washed in the ladies' toilets at work. The toad remained, somewhere in the walls of the kitchen, somewhere biding its time. She got used to its trails of slime on the floor and to seeing the neat little lines of poison granules skittered and scattered all over the place, as if two powerful back legs had kicked them disdainfully out of the way. When she finally got through to Rentokil, they apologised and said they were experiencing an unprecedented demand on their services, and unless it was an emergency, she would have to wait her turn. Monica decided that the toad wasn't really a life or death situation and told Rentokil not to worry. Instead, she phoned an estate agent. She didn't mention the toad to anybody, and she avoided Tom as much as possible, as though the thing in her kitchen was an embarrassing illness or personal hygiene problem that she needed to deal with on her own. Tom, anyway, was preoccupied. The ratings on his show had slumped. Meanwhile, the stinks continued, and all over the weekend, the London Fire Brigade reported a high rise in prank calls and wasted journeys. It was that time of year, the pundits on the 24-hour news said. Kids' pranks, Halloween excitement. The shops were selling fireworks already. Accidents would happen. And yet the rest of the country seemed as calm and stink-free as ever. By the second week, the culture of stoic disavowal had become the norm. Board meetings, plays, expensive lunches, and courtships all carried on regardless of interruption from the unsavoury, intimate stenches. If a stink went off on a crowded tube train, grim-faced passengers looked down at their shoes and held their breath until the next station. If an incident occurred in a pub or nightclub, the landlord simply turned on the fans and passed round free cigars, flouting the smoking ban with an evocation of the Blitz spirit. As with tube strikes, terrorist attacks, overcrowding, the price of property, and pigeons with horribly deformed feet, Londoners privately assumed that this was just another test of endurance the city had thought up for them, and that to admit defeat, or even express disgust, would be to show a lack of commitment, a failing of nerve. Living in the city was dirty work. The stuff it threw in your face was to be wiped discreetly away and not complained about. It was not a place for waverers or the highly strung. If you were one of those, you were better off moving to the country. Or if you couldn't afford to do that, to the nonentity of zones 3 to 6 and the shame of an 0208 landline. That was what Monica thought most of her London friends and colleagues believed. And of course, she was right. In the end, it was a school of American tourists who breached the levy of silence. Standing expectantly in front of the Swiss chiming clock in Leicester Square, they were caught in the epicentre of a particularly noisome blast, and after a few moments spluttering and gagging on their own rising gorges, their leader called the police and made an official complaint. The evening papers reported it as a joke at first, printing a photograph of the American tourists looking imperious and stern, but as people travelled home on the tube that night, or packed themselves onto buses, they saw the headline, and they weren't laughing. Tentatively, people began to talk about the stinks, just as the stinks reached their full malignancy and the weather took a turn for the worst. Not since the great post-war smogs had London suffered so badly from noxious gases and low-slung, airless skies. Not since Sherlock Holmes walked the cobbled streets had whole swathes of the city been swallowed up by grey-green fogs. Some of the most virulent stink eruptions actually combusted into screwed-up balls of coloured flame, blue, red, and in one well-documented case, a striking emerald green. The city's fire services were stretched to the limit, chasing will-o'-the-wisps up blind alleys, only to find a few singed pieces of litter and a gloating putrid stench that made them glad they brought their breathing apparatus. The city's sewer system was in a constant state of flushing and assessment. Divers dredged the rivers and canals, and hospitals reported unusual cases of phantom dysentery, mass hysteria, and in one case, suspected plague. Pubs and restaurants closed because no one felt like eating. Perfume sales went through the roof, and so did the sales of oranges and cloves after Jeremy Paxman went on Newsnight and demonstrated a do-it-yourself pomander. As the third week of the month wore on, tourists cancelled hotel reservations, and with half-term just a few days away, there was talk of evacuating all the children under 12 to tents on Salisbury Plain. Apart from quick darts to the shops or to walk or to work, people mostly stayed at home, watching the news and blogging about the stinks. At Monica's offices, everyone had Jo Malone candles burning on their desks, so that the atmosphere was hot and pungent with clashing aromatherapy. One woman had a nervous breakdown in the middle of the canteen when a puny stink went off in her salad. She was given 6 weeks paid leave, and Monica found herself wondering if she could swing the same kind of deal. Tom asked sniffily for his aftershave back, and Monica ran out of excuses for why she kept forgetting to bring it in. At home, the toad was getting more and more adventurous. There was slime now on the kitchen worktops, and a big splatter of it on the calendar. Then at the beginning of the fourth week, the heads of the channel decided that because of the stinks and a growing aversion to all things ghoulish and graveside, they should pull Tom's live Halloween special and bring the series to a premature close. Tom was furious. He took Monica to one side and communicated in fierce whispers and a semaphore of raised eyebrows and cheek twitches that if she couldn't stick up for him and his show, then she wasn't the woman he'd thought she was and that they were over. Driving home that evening to her flat and to her toad, Monica found herself strangely elated. It felt good to no longer be the woman Tom thought she was. It was also good that his show had been pulled and that she didn't have to go to work on Monday. She looked out of the windscreen and noticed that for the first time in several days, she could see a moon in the sky. The clouds looked thinner and more silvery too, and she realised that it was almost 24 hours since she'd been caught up in anything worse than a sharp blast of wet gun dog. Not daring to hope too much, as soon as she was home, she went straight to the kitchen. This time the toad was waiting for her, squatting in the middle of the floor in its own pool of ooze. Once again it stuck out its tongue, slowly, lasciviously. But this time Monica was not disgusted. Slowly she crouched down on the floor and held out her hand toward the creature. When it didn't move, she shuffled nearer to it and began speaking to it in a soft, crooning voice. "Are you hungry, Mr. Toad? Would you like some nice juicy flies?" She didn't actually have any flies, but there was a jar of dried fruit in the larder, and everyone always said that currants looked like squash flies. She sprinkled a handful on the floor close to the toad and stood back with a fond smile as it flicked out its tongue and nabbed first one currant and then several more in quick succession. She left it there with the door open while she went through to the other room and turned the TV on. The stinks were no longer the top news story. In fact, they were actually getting better, the reporter said, though no one was any the wiser as to what had caused them. The weather forecast was looking a lot more promising too. A cold, clear snap was coming, a frost possibly over the weekend, and the clocks were going back as well. A movement in the corner of her eye made Monica glance up. The toad had come out of the kitchen and was squatting by the French doors that led out to the garden. It looked at Monica with its golden eyes, and a slither of tongue flickered over its glistening head. Monica pulled herself reluctantly out of her armchair and padded over to the French doors. "If I let you out now, don't expect to come back in again straight away," she warned the toad in a stone voice. The toad carried on staring up at her. "Okay then, if that's what you want." She unlocked the doors and opened them both wide. A gust of icy breeze swirled in from the night, as clean and crisp as mentholyptus. The toad waddled round so that it was facing the garden, and then heaved itself out through the doorway and across the flags of the patio. "It was nice having you," Monica called after it. "Good luck out there." Then she shut the doors against the night and turned back to the TV.